I'd like to ask our next speaker to come up, and while he's getting prepared. So this has been a very information-packed session, and we have one more speaker to go. So in the context of your award coming, in addition to all the information you're getting, it will be a break if you can stick with us. And our next speaker is Derek Roos, who's an assistant professor at the School of Computer Science here at McGill. And so you've heard, I think, about really three different complementary approaches, and now we're going to hear about yet another one, which is social network modeling.
Thank you. I have good news. There's actually relationships between what I'm going to talk about and what we've talked about over the past three lectures. So, in my research, I'm interested in sort of the general idea is modeling complex systems using networks by representing them as interacting entities and understanding their structure and the way that that structure drives the behavior of those entities. I've recently begun a project looking at obesity and trying to understand the actual, not just links between peer groups and obesity, but also trying to understand the actual causal relationships between those, which, as I'll explain, are somewhat different from what's been done in the past. But before I get into that, and so what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to give a very brief introduction to sort of what social network modeling is and then talk a little bit about the approach that I'm taking. But before I get into that, social networks, what is a social network? Well, it's probably one of the most hyped terms that we hear nowadays. So I'm sure everyone's seen it and is familiar with some aspect of it. But just briefly, a social network is effectively when you take a group of individuals where each individual is a we call it a node, and you give it a set of properties: its gender, its body mass index, its hair color. You know, just pick a set of properties that you could associate with that individual. You take this group of individuals and you basically connect them according to some predefined notion of what a relationship is, and that relationship can be a variety of different things. If you're interested in looking at friendship circles, then you would use the way that people designate their friends. If you're interested in looking at co-publication, you could look at people who co-author with one another, or you can really pick any relationship that you might be interested in. But once you select that relationship, the network that you've constructed gives you some idea of the interrelationship between those individuals according to your defined sense of connectivity. And I actually want to just pause here and say that it's rather fortunate that I come after the presentation on agent-based modeling, because actually there's a tremendous amount of sort of shared material between the two disciplines, in the sense that you can really think about a social network as a group of agents in which we are specifically interested in the context defined by declared relationships between those agents. This is benefits and weaknesses, just as agent-based learning does. One of the benefits that you get from it is you have a very structured sense in which to understand each of the agents, and that allows you to make stronger statements about some of the relationships and some of the properties that those agents may have. And so that's really where social networking can benefit. It can give you insight into the social context and how that social context influences and is influenced by various properties of these individuals. Now, there's been a tremendous amount of work done on the idea of health and obesity and peers. I'm actually just entering this area, so my talk comes with a caveat that you've heard in previous talks. If I do say something about obesity and it sounds a little fishy, it's probably wrong. But that said, there's been a tremendous amount of work done in the area of health and peer circles, and I think what's been well established is that there is a correlation between obesity and the peer groups that you have, the relationships that you have. What's not clear, and what really hasn't been explored in great detail yet, is what this correlation actually says, is why this correlation exists. And really, within the context of this workshop and within the context of sort of the research program that it is a part of, understanding the reasons why these are connected is fundamental to designing interventions and policies that can actually reverse some of these correlations that we see. And so the fundamental question that we would ask is, do peer groups reinforce unhealthy lifestyle choices? Or otherwise, how are peers and health correlated. And in order to do this, we really have to step beyond looking at correlations, which is where we just sort of look at general patterns in networks, which is a huge area of research. And we have to start thinking about how we're actually going to model these systems. And by model, what I mean is, how are we actually going to provide a quantitative description of how those relationships change and how individual properties change over time. And when we use a model, it allows us to, it gives us two major benefits. The first is it can actually identify causal relationships that explain these correlations that we see. And I have near in parentheses because the idea of actually finding the exact causal relationships is a pretty dangerous direction to go in quantitative analysis. Very rarely do you actually find the explicit cause, but often you can find things that really give you a much better understanding of what's going on, and that's ultimately what we seek. And really the way that we can get information about these causes is by teasing the model apart, and we'll see that in the next several slides. This having a model also allows us to actually do predictive work, so we can design an intervention. We can modify the model that we've built that basically characterizes the behavior of the system, and we can propagate that effect. We can simulate it over time, and we can see the kinds of properties that we see emerge over time, much in the same way that we looked at even the Anastasi example, where you simulate over time and you observe how the system behaves. Well, we can do the same thing with networks and by focusing on peer groups. And so there has been some work done on models of social network formation. However, it's a fairly early and young area, and I think that that's largely because the idea of actually trying to build good descriptive and predictive models of these is very difficult, largely because you need a lot of data in order to figure out the parameters that you're interested in, and you need to have a fairly solid idea as to how you're going to model social interaction. But that said, so let's talk about what a model of social network formation would look like. In general, so we're going to have, we have this network, and I have an example up here, actually. So we have this network, and we observe it at three different points in time. We take a look at it, and here you see this network, and I've just labeled it with properties. Each node has a property, and it's a number between 0 and 1. And so we look at it at this point in time, and then we come back a month later, and we look at it, and we've noticed that the value for this node has changed. Whatever property we were measuring for that individual has changed. It's gone from 0.6 to 0.7. And then we come back a month later, and we observe that this value is the same, but all of a sudden this edge has dropped out. These two people no longer identify each other as friends. And so the question would be, how do we formal description of what's going on here? And there's really two, when we come up with a model, it's going to have two pieces. It's going to have rules for how these interactions and relationships come and go out of the model. And it's going to have rules for how these node properties change. How did the value go from 0.6 to 0.7 over a period of time? And in general, we're going to enforce two properties on this model. We're going to expect two things from it. First, it's going to have to use socially plausible mechanics. Teleportation and anti-gravity are not two things that we can decide to involve in this model. It has to actually involve things that we would expect to observe in a social system. And the second parameter, which is in some sense a much more difficult thing to enforce, is the networks that we generate. So this model is generative in the sense that we'll have rules that will say, okay, the next thing you should do is you should add an edge here. The next thing you should do is you should change this value here. As we do that, we're going to basically generate new artificial networks, but those artificial networks should look like real social networks. Now, defining that what things look like is a very, very tricky issue, and that's one of the things that's been a huge obstacle to trying to build these models in the past. Fortunately, with the arrival of a lot of these longitudinal data sets, it's becoming possible to actually do this kind of analysis. But prior to doing that, it was very difficult to define what a social network even looked like. And so the model that I've started with and that I think illustrates the way that social network modeling can progress and really can offer insights is this two-rule model of social network formation. And it involves two rules. One rule determines how edges are formed and lost, and that's homophily, which is basically says people who are similar to one another, or people seek out people who are similar to one another. So they form relationships with like-minded or like people. And then influence tells us how node properties change over time. So, and that basically says, if I'm with a group of people, if I have declared relationships with these people, they exert influence on my properties, and I exert influence on them. So you can already see that this becomes a very complicated system because we have simultaneous influence occurring along all the different edges of the network. And so this model by itself can actually describe what we saw in this toy example. So here we observe it at time zero. We come back in a month. And this node value has changed. It's actually increased. And if we're, let's say for the moment that we're talking about some normalized measure of BMI, right, just to tie this into this discussion of obesity and health, well, effectively what's happened is there's been an element of influence in which this cluster of nodes, this node here, 0.8 and 0.9, have exerted influence on the property of this node to actually increase its attribute, to increase the value. And then we look at it down the road in another month, and we notice that this edge has dropped out. Well, we can actually invoke this rule to describe what's happened, this idea of homophily, where this node has now diverged from the similarity with these two agents. And so it's no longer close enough in order to be considered friend status. And so we can build a model like this that actually allows us to describe effectively how the system behaves. Now, one of the things that I said early on, which you may have noticed, is that it has to be socially plausible. And as far as we know, obesity and BMI is not contagious. So I actually have not described a plausible biological or plausible social model yet, because effectively all I said is that when two people get together who have different BMIs, their BMIs converge. And that's actually not going to directly happen. So let's go ahead and see if we can fill this out. And again, this is a toy example. But suppose for a moment that video games are highly correlated with obesity. That the sedentary activity of playing video games, and I have no idea if this is correlated whatsoever, but for the moment let's just entertain that possibility. Well, we can restate homophily as the tendency to associate with individuals who play similar amounts of video games. And influence would be that the amount of time that I spend playing a video game converges with the amount of time my friends spend playing video games, which both sound very reasonable. So that also fits the example that we have here. We have this cluster of people who play video games. 0.6 is sort of sitting at the nexus of a bunch of people who play a lot of video games. So this person starts playing a bit more video games. And then this person starts playing more video games, which means he can't really hang out with 0.5 down here. So they sort of part ways. And so there we have the social network evolving. Now, if video games are actually causally related to obesity, then this network also describes the basically prevalence and the spread of obesity, because if they're causally linked, then effectively these normalized hours of playing video games correspond to normalized BMIs. And again, extremely toy example, but the idea being that obesity and many other properties that we might want to measure are actually second, third, fourth, fifth order effects of networks, meaning that they are not the things that are explicitly modified by peers. And network modeling actually allows us to not just investigate this, but actually elucidate what properties are being modified and study those correlations more carefully. And not to mention, so the idea that we build this model means that intervention can be done a little bit more intelligently. Rather than just busting up groups of kids that seem to be a little overweight, we actually go in and we look at how we deal with video game usage, for example. Now, the problem, of course, is I've already proposed a model. How do you actually arrive at a model that gives you that you have some confidence with? And again, this is one of those challenges where there's going to be a lot of iterative work with modeling, simulation, looking at the data, trying to fit the data, looking at it. And we return to a lot of the issues that were raised with agent-based modeling. There's no guarantee that the set of rules that you identify are going to guarantee that you have arrived at the correct model. But it should give you you should be able to sleep well at night if you know that you have a huge data set and you've actually been able to reproduce effectively most of the behaviors seen that you observe in that data using this theoretical model. And the discrepancies that you see are not necessarily faults of the model, necessarily of your modeling effort. It simply elucidates places where you need to identify other variables. But in brief, the way that you would actually go about building such a model, really you have to originally start with an idea of what are going to be your basic rules. Sort of going back to this agent-based modeling idea, what are going to be the principles by which your agents interact or build their network and influence one another? I proposed homophily and influence. There's tons of other properties. There's heterophily or heterophilia, where people actually see people who are different from one another. There's all sorts of different things that you can actually build into this model. Once you've arrived at those, the question then becomes what these individual rules are functions of. So you have to select the properties that they act on. Homophily is actually a very complicated function. If homophily actually exists, we're probably not using one property to determine what that is. We actually have very complicated functions by which we determine who's similar to me and who's not similar to me. And so we actually have to come up with some way of describing that. Now, the benefit of having a formalized model is and data is that we can actually come up with a generalized framework and identify a very long laundry list of potential properties, and through simulation, actually explore the space of possible values that you could choose for these properties, effectively weight different properties differently, looking for ones that actually reproduce networks that you see in real life, reproduce the behavior that you observe in your data. Now, that takes a lot of simulation. What I italicize here, so everything down to about 2 is what you can find in literature. People have done basically down to 2. Because you can come up with these ideas of homophily, of influence, you can try out these different rules, you can even generate networks and say, do these look like what I would see in real life? And say, yeah, that looks pretty close. And then say, okay, we've gained some insight into social behavior. But when we're actually looking at perturbing the system, we need to do better than just saying, okay, I think these set of rules would generate something socially reasonable. We actually need the parameters that say, yes, this is actually what's going on, so that when I try perturbing the system, it actually gives me a reasonable estimate of what's going to happen, of the way that obesity would propagate, of the way that video game usage would change. And so this italicized element is actually what I'm working on in my research, but I think is an important direction for future work in this area and would certainly have a lot to offer the community of health and obesity research from the standpoint that it allows you to really articulate the kind of influences that peers have on obesity and on these different traits. And so just sort of highlight some of the complexities of this modeling process. So we talked about how homophily is very complicated. The question there would be, what individual attributes do determine friend circles? And I pose these questions not just as modeling questions in the abstract, but also as questions for the community to think about. Because when it really comes down to it, a lot of these questions are going to have to be answered in circles beyond computational modeling. It's going to have to be answered by domain experts who can actually offer insight into this. Homophily isn't the only possible edge rule. So how else do people form relationships with one another, particularly if we're talking about children? How do they form relationships? Is it classroom associations? Is it extracurricular activities? Influence is not a universal parameter. We know that there are various hierarchies among people, among adults, among children. How do we model the relative influence that different people have on one another? Obtaining network data can be very difficult. Now, I'm familiar with the AdHealth data. We've had a number of other data sets presented which have very promising, which provide very promising results. So can we actually incorporate some of this information? Is it sufficient to actually give us a picture of what's going on? Would we be comfortable with the models that we would build if we could reproduce things that look like that data? Is that sufficient? And then finally, this question, which I really have sidestepped, which is defining how real-world social networks look. It's a very open question. I'd be happy to speak with some of you afterwards about it because there's a number of ideas about it. But generally, the idea is that you have to define something about the social network that would be universal across all true social networks. So, for example, community structure is one. There's been a lot of work into community structure identifying the fact that social networks have community. They tend to exhibit clustering in various places. And so one test would be, does the network that I generate exhibit this kind of community structure? But clearly, we need more than just one parameter to test with. And then once again, I mean, the benefits of building these kind of models, I think, extend far beyond just understanding these relationships. It also gives you something that you can formally perturb and actually quantitatively measure the effect of interventions that you might try. With that, I will take any questions.
Before I open question, I have to commend you on ending exactly on time with a split-second precision. I don't think I've seen that yet.
Thank you very much, Derek, for a clear presentation. I very much have the same, I appreciate the idea for using the evolving social networks for any kind of policy design and intervention design. I was wondering, for estimating the rules for example, whether homophily is an important contributor or not, whether it is better to use simulation or try to use the statistical methods, if you have data, dynamic data for what links were created and what went away, why should we use simulation and then try to compare the distributions of network configurations rather than just use normal statistical methods for estimating those relationships?
Well, I think that there are two reasons. The first is that if you had enough data to do that, then that might be actually a very reasonable approach or a reasonable place to start. In fact, expectation maximization is almost based on sort of these sort of ideas, right? You sort of look at what you've got, you try to reproduce, you calculate parameters, then you reproduce it. But I think one of the more challenging questions is that the data itself doesn't actually contain cause-effect information. I mean, and this is something that I think that there's actually a very fundamental result from causality theory, right, that says that if you're only observing a system, you can't infer very much about cause and effect because you're not actively perturbing the system. And if you could go in and actually yank out a kid and then see what happened, that might actually give you more information. But barring that, you're actually not going to be able to really perturb the system and obtain the cause-effect relationships that might give you the information that you need to know. Because homophily, influence, these are things where there's a cause, there's an effect, and there's a chain of events. And you can't necessarily see those in data.
Okay. So that's an interesting point about cause and effect. But you're not really doing the causality analysis on the real system, right? You can only do it on your simulation. And so in the real system, you can observe a time series. That's perhaps a very good proxy for, you know, things being causal. Something that's happened in the past causes something that happens in the future. But it's not quite the same thing. So to what extent sort of perturbing your simulation and seeing that the end result looks like a real system actually tells you that you've identified the correct causality relationships?
I think that's probably the million-dollar question in this area. And I think that it's one of the things that's definitely really challenged the work that's even currently going on. I think that there are a couple things in there, actually. So if you look at what data is currently available, like if you look at the AdHealth data, I mean, it's an extraordinary data set, and it represents an immense effort. But really, as far as network goes, we only have like 4 time samples. And those are over a period of years. So the idea that we could actually take the real data and somehow deconvolve some of these very low-level parameters like homophily between two individuals, I find it difficult to imagine a way in which we could actually try to tease some of these explicit values out. Now, that's not to say that you couldn't try to build functions. You couldn't test out your function for homophily, like come up with a function for it and then test it on the data and see if it actually holds up. The way that these simulation approaches generally tend to work is you actually begin with the initial network. So you start with AdHealth time 0. And then you evolve, you basically simulate, and you do thousands and thousands of these simulations, and you look at sort of the statistical distribution of these. And I agree. I don't know that it gives you 100% confidence that you're reproducing the effects or that your model is absolutely correct, but if you observe things within a very small statistical or narrow statistical sort of distribution around what you've defined to be socially plausible or the networks that you're interested in, then I think given current technology and current techniques, you'd be challenged to do better, I think. Unfortunately, I think that's the practical response.
Hi, that was a beautiful talk, very nice and clear, and thank you. I wanted to perhaps complicate it a little bit more, or get your opinion about whether this is perhaps not a complication, but the third possible mechanism is a shared environmental background, such as kids living in the same neighborhood and, they've got lots of fast food and no grocery stores or something like that. And given the limitations of a data set like Ad Health, where really when you're talking about the network formation, it's really only two time points that you have, this is a third type of potential explanation. Do you have any ideas about how to incorporate that sort of contextual effect?
I was actually going to corner one of the former speakers and talk to him about that, actually. I think that it was very relevant. Actually, while I was putting this presentation together, I was thinking about it, because effectively what social networks allow you to do and what network analysis in general allows you to do is evaluate any correlations, evaluate sort of cause within that happens within the network system. And so looking at extraneous variables can be very difficult to do as long as you're constraining your network model to just the links that you see. Now, it's entirely possible that you could look at, building more hybridized model where you actually allow dependency between attributes that nodes share without actually sharing an explicit link. The other way to model it, which would be more pure social networking, more pure networking, is you could actually build a hyper network in which you would actually represent links that represent different kinds of relationships. So you have social relationships and then you have geographical relationships. So if you're in the same neighborhood, presumably you actually have some type of connectivity there as well. Exactly. And it has been done. I mean, you can actually, it's called, you can color the edges or you can label the edges with what they represent. And you can do some sort of analysis on top of that. And there's no reason that wouldn't give you at least some estimation of the kind of the kind of variables that you're interested in looking at.
Hi, Derek. It's a very powerful technique, but don't you think that when you are adding the social networking, those stringency, you are actually getting more and more false negatives, depending upon your cutoff and stringency.
False negatives of what?
So that you are picking up some of those risk factors or what of those actually there by chance. How you negate that?
Overfitting the data.
Well, yes, that's always a danger, particularly when you have a fairly small amount of data to try to fit. You can certainly easily fall into that trap. I think that this is where good rule design comes in, because if you've actually designed the rules so that they're not overfit to the specific system that you're looking at, then presumably the parameters that fit those rules should give you some estimate of the social behavior. But I mean, there's really, as far as I can see in the literature and as far as what's been done, I have never seen anyone being able to put error bounds on anything in social network analysis, mainly for this reason that trying to actually say something firm about how exactly your data matches or your simulated data matches the data itself is very difficult to do. And that's why we do the statistical sampling. You run thousands and thousands of these simulations, and you get error bars that say just how narrow your predictions are and how they match things. But
let's take one more question before we go
forward. First, just a comment that in the public health agency, we're working with somebody who's looking at social networking to look at the transmission of tuberculosis. But that's just a comment. The question is that we are now beginning to see a number of social networks in cyberspace. whether it's Facebook or even some simulated network games and so on. Mm-hmm. The question is, do you think those can be used to validate some of the things that you postulate in models? And secondly, could such networks or simulated cyber networks, do you think, might be useful for modulating behavior?
Well, to answer your second question first, I think that they absolutely can, because they represent relationships that two individuals have. And I think as we're discovering, particularly for the younger generations, these are very, very real relationships. Now, another project that I'm working on is Twitter. I'm looking at analysis of Twitter. And I've been looking at the number of people that follow individuals, and it's outrageous. I mean, there's some people out there who are college students, and they have like 4,000 people following them. So it definitely creates a different sense for what a relationship is. I wouldn't necessarily give it the same weight as a face-to-face interaction. And this actually goes back to sort of talking about having a network in which we label the edges, because it may be that different edges need to be given different weights. I mean, if we're talking about influence happens along edges, happens through interactions. And if I have a face-to-face interaction with somebody who can sit there and make fun of me or berate me or compliment me, then that may be a lot stronger than having somebody on a Twitter feed who blogs about the tennis shoes that he's wearing, right? Those are just two completely different, I don't know, levels of effect, but I think it's still there. To your second point, I think that you were saying, can we actually validate? In some sense, I think it answers the bigger question of can we validate social network modeling in general? And one of the reasons why I have sort of multiple threads going in social networks is because I think it's going to be hard to obtain enough data in one place to say social networking analysis or social networking modeling, it absolutely works under all cases. We need to sort of understand in the different contexts and figure out when it works and when it doesn't. And so I think that looking at online networks is great because you can actually get the links very easily. You can construct a network very quickly, and you can start to model some of these things. And the initial results that we get is that, yes, you can actually, they are validating some of the results because you actually can build models that reproduce sort of the growth of these networks. But, I mean, stay tuned. That's ongoing.
So it was a really clear presentation, but now I'm quite confused, actually, about the difference between social network analysis as an analytic tool versus as a simulation tool. So when I read the Christakis and Fowler paper, I understood that to be a way of analyzing data without simulation per se, but they told us about the importance of those relationships to, well, the newspapers made it into obesity is contagious, but clearly it's more about behavior somewhere in there. Versus a recent paper that came out, which I don't know if you've seen it, by Bear, which was purely a simulation of social networks, both scale-free and small world, that then came up with these absurd predictions about if you pin certain people at their body weight, then they can have a huge effect on other people. And it was kind of a ridiculous set of conclusions, which disappoint me that modelers are getting out there and making ridiculous conclusions. But help me understand that distinction between social network analysis and social network as a simulation tool.
I was actually struggling with exactly this question when making this presentation because I wasn't sure which one to talk about, frankly, because they are very distinct. They're very related, but they're very distinct. Social network analysis is focused on taking a network that currently exists, or even a set of networks, and understanding the properties of nodes and of edges within that system. So it's very focused on, like in the Fowler and Christakis paper, what they really looked at were subgraphs. They looked at how subgraphs changed over time. Sort of groups within this network. I'm sorry, yeah. So they focused on groups within this network, and they showed how obesity increased or decreased in these groups. And they could say there's various measures like community structure, there's centrality, there's various things that allow you to say, okay, this is a significant group, this stands by itself, and we observed that obesity increases in it. Now, the conclusions that they drew were statistically sound from the standpoint that there absolutely is a correlation between obesity and peer structure. I think they, and not just they, there's been multiple papers that have asserted that. What isn't clear is what caused it. We can observe it in the data, and social network analysis allows us to draw those correlations out. Social network modeling, and it's a very overloaded word, but social network modeling, I'm talking about here to mean how do we actually model the social network transformation, how social networks change over time. And deriving a model, as in telling us, if you're here, then you will go to, then if your network looks like this, the next step that your network will take will look like this, or this, or this, or this, is very different than saying, what does this component of the network look like? Does that
clear some of that up? Is the only question you're going to do in the simulation then related to what the network looks like? Can you, you can also simulate relationships and what the consequent obesity is and things like that?
Yes, absolutely. So what you watch over time is because we have, in the case of homophilian influence, what we saw was that if we built a model, our model described that little toy example that I had. So my simulation, my simple model, could have generated that progression that you saw. So we could have actually run the simulation and seen whether the prevalence of obesity increased or decreased. And then you could apply a perturbation to that and say, okay, you know what? We're not going to let any more than four people play video games for more than 4 hours. What does that do to the spread of obesity in the network? And then you can rerun the simulation effectively. And you can always run social network analysis inside your simulation. So you use the analytical techniques in order to just gain insight into what your simulation is doing.
Okay, I'm going to have to, due to my terrible no moderating, we're half an hour late, and so I think it's only fair that everybody gets a chance. So please, I'm sure the speaker will be happy to follow up with you during the break. But we really do need to leave some time for the plenary, because now you've heard all about the data, all about the methods. We need to just sort of let it all settle for about 5-10 minutes, and then we're going to come back and figure out how it all mushes together here. So thank you very much, Derek, and thank you, everybody.